All right, we are here with, I think, Uva Bowl. Is that the correct pronunciation? Because I was saying Uwe the whole last show, and I think that's
Uwe,
wrong.
Uwe.
You tell me.
Yeah, it's Uwe.
All right.
The mystery is solved.
Or yeah. We could just call you Dr. Bowl, too, if you want.
I like that.
Well, I think Uwe is okay.
Okay, Uwe is okay.
All right, Uwe it is. You saw our last episode or some of it, presumably, because you said you wanted to kind of discuss some stuff that we talked about in there. So let me just ask you right off the bat, we covered you from what articles I could find and, all that stuff. What do you think, if anything, was inaccurate about the episode we did?
So first of all, Michelin stars. So for the restaurant. Canada is not getting tested by Michelin. So in Canada, whatever you do, you are not getting a Michelin star.
Why is that? Do you know why they're snubbing Canada?
So Michelin is in Paris, right? So they make a decision what countries or what cities they go and test and what not. For example, they dumped Los Angeles 3 years ago. So in Los Angeles were various Michelin star restaurants, and now nobody has a Michelin star anymore because they're not going there anymore. In US, they do Napa Valley, San Francisco, what is both close together, and Chicago and New York. And no other city in US has a Michelin star. If you have a great restaurant in Dallas or whatever,
you're fucked.
Yeah, shut a lot.
Exactly.
At least in terms of getting a Michelin star.
So it's carefully curated, and it's kind of like rigged. It's only if the areas that you have a restaurant are in those areas are you going to be able to even have the possibility of getting a Michelin star.
I mean, it seems to me like it should be based on the quality of the restaurant, not the location of the restaurant.
We watched a very interesting clip of you in a previous interview that you did where you talked about your initial dream being to open a pizza house. And I was fascinated by that as a giant fat fuck that literally hoovers pizza down my giant gullet all day. What would the Uwe Boll Pizza House have been if it had been the right time for you to break into that market?
That was very early in Vancouver. You couldn't get any good pizza at all. It was horrible. So Domino's was basically what you get.
Is disgusting.
Yeah. So, and then I wanted to bring in the original Italian oven, like the wood fire oven, rotoforno. So rotoforno is you have that stone thing, but it rotates. Remember the ovens where they have to shuffle the pizza close to the fire and then one side is burnt, basically. So the rotoforno has the same, because it rotates, the pizza gets baked basically perfectly. And then, of course, you have to do the dough. Like a good pizza dough takes 2 days. You have to make it. It has to stay overnight in the fridge because the yeast develops. And then you can make out of the pizza ball the next day the pizza. Also, this didn't ever happen, right? So, I mean, whatever, a Dr. Oetker frozen pizza is actually better as the stuff we got here. So that drove it for me. And then, of course, you need a nice lasagna, some pasta, tiramisu, like the classical appetizers, where vitello tonnato or carpaccio. So stuff what I love, and it was not there. So, but then later when I actually felt opening a restaurant, now we have 7 or 8 good pizza places in Vancouver. So it was not a niche anymore.
So right. Then Bajas is born. You're very passionate about Bajas. I'd like to hear what you believe the finest dish at Bajas is currently.
Let's say the most expensive dish to make and the most labor-intensive dish is German Sauerbraten. It's actually from my hometown, Cologne. So what you do is you take a big top round beef roast, you pan fry it very dark, then you put it in a pot, and you cover it with red wine, vinegar, apple juice, and spices. So, and then you leave it 4 days in that pot. So you turn every day the meat around, and then you braise it 8 hours. So you get the meat almost falls apart. The sauce is then super dark and super nice. And that you eat with potato dumplings and red cabbage. So not a lot of restaurants, even in Germany, do that dish because it takes 4 days. So it means like you always need four pots parallel developing, basically.
Right. Me and TJ here actually lived in Columbus, Ohio, and they have a very famous German restaurant called Schmitz, and they actually do sauerbraten. So I actually have had it just by happenstance. Good. So it is a really good dish. I will agree with
that. So we were looking at your Twitter, which I love your Twitter, by the way.
Me too.
Yeah.
And I was looking at your it was a very popular post you did from January 31st where you talk about the stuff you hate and the stuff you like. And I thought we could go through it and you could maybe tell me why you hate the things that are on the hate list and why you like the things that are on the like list maybe. So the first thing you hate, Star Wars, which everybody loves Star Wars except for you. So go ahead and tell us why.
Well, except for Uwe and Roger Ebert at first.
Yeah, Roger Ebert did not like Star Wars initially, but whatever. Go
the
ahead.
Initial Star Wars, I think the initial, because I turned into a hater because of all that endless milking the franchise.
Well, yeah, I can agree with that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Wholeheartedly agree with you there.
Yeah. So, but like, when it comes to the initial trilogy, how'd you feel about it at the time and its place in film history? I know you think that it led to too many of these blockbusters being made.
Yeah, but I know the initial thing, I liked it because it was like practical, done without a lot of CGI. It was just like they built the little machines, the little robots and whatever. It was kind of the beginning of this kind of sci-fi era we are in. And I liked the characters, you know, so it had humor. It was like Harrison Ford, I think, was on his best at that point in his career. And so I liked it, right? But then it got too serious. Even the third episode of the original one was already, for me, like, went slowly downhill.
Right.
So I felt like that fascination was gone. And growing up without internet, growing up without a lot of, let's say, choices in TV, no Netflix and all that stuff, to go in a movie theater was a real, like... Yeah, it was great and an adventure. And so I was looking forward for movies. You saw the preview in the theater, and then you waited 6 months to finally watch the movie. That is all replaced now by anything at any time. You know, like you can watch anything you want around the.
Do you think it diminishes like the specialness of watching a movie or watching a TV show when it's just everything is just so instantaneous and on demand that it kind of kills the unique sort of special feeling you get when you watch a great film or something like that?
Yeah, you know, it's this kind of like where you feel like. What's going on? Like, I don't know how many Avengers crap shit I have to watch. I mean, it's like, it's just an endless loop. And then comes Captain Marvel and this. I mean, it's just like the same over and over again. And
it's very derivative.
Yeah. And it made me very upset when I'm sure on the list is maybe even Black Panther, right? Because I think it's so funny that.
Let me just tell you the whole list. You have video games, gamers, nerds, Marvel, DC, the Avengers. That's your whole hate list other than Star Wars there. Video games and gamers is kind of interesting because you've done so many video game adaptations yourself. So tell me, how did that come about? Was it doing the video game adaptations and dealing with gamers that led you to have that sort of like visceral, like fuck you sort of thing towards them?
Yes, because it at one point you recognize that whatever you do, it doesn't satisfy them or whatever. They hate it. And I think it's one of the reasons like video game based movies never got really good reviews.
No, you're right.
I agree with that.
I can't think of a single one.
Well, even look at Warcraft, and that's a huge budget movie, and I mean, people just ripped it to shreds.
Yeah. Do you think that gamers are just unpleasable when it comes to an adaptation of their film, and that's why, you know, people shy away from making them?
They're so living in that kind of world. I mean, my son plays Fortnite every day 6 hours, right? So I cannot stop him. The only way to stop him is to smash his Nintendo into the wall.
Yes.
And but I can only imagine what would happen. What would happen if you actually make a movie now, like a Fortnite movie? I think it would get trashed. Into
oh God,
the-
yes.
Well, if anybody's gonna make one, it should be you. Because I think that only you could do justice to Fortnite. Only you. It's a. I think my personal views on Fortnite is that it's probably one of the worst things that's ever happened to video games.
Oh, dude, when there was that joke of Elon Musk saying he bought Fortnite, I was like, please let this be true, man. Just buy Fortnite and shut it down.
Because you have a way of taking the basic premise of the game and then building something else out of it, and that's what would have to be done if somebody was going to make something out of Fortnite.
Yeah, I mean, that is the other thing. Like, when you have, like, take Dungeon Siege. So the movie I did with Jason Statham and so on. So it's like, there is no story to Dungeon Siege. It's to the game from Gas Power Games, right? So it's now changed to, it's another developer, Epic or whatever.
Sure.
But they bought it. And it's there is no story. So then you get criticized for that you put a story in. But if you confront the nerds or whatever, you say, look, okay, what is if there would be actually no story? I make just a movie with actors running senselessly around, and then trying to hide because they're like the Crux or that orc guys trying to catch them. I mean, what is this? It doesn't make any sense.
It's not a movie.
So one of the things you hate is nerds. What to you is a nerd, and why do you hate them?
No, the nerds, in a way. When you discuss the boxing fights, for example, right? So, that were nerds.
Yeah, and you beat the shit out of all of them.
Yeah, clearly.
Yeah. But the thing was, I did that application to say, look, I want to beat you up because of the reviews I got for Blood Rain. So I felt after House of the Dead and Alone in the Dark, when the Blood Rain reviews came out, I got the same reviews. Like the worst piece of shit ever, whatever, right? So I felt like, okay, but you can at least watch the movie if you write a review. And a lot of people actually admitted that they didn't even watch the movie.
See, that's bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, if you write a review, if let's say you're a real reviewer on a real newspaper or a radio channel, whatever, I mean, at least you should have the courtesy to watch the movie and then trash it into the ground. It's not that I expected great reviews for the movies, but when you read a review and you saw that they actually, or during you read it, like there is actually, there has no knowledge what happened in the movie, it's just they watched the trailer and wrote the whole review, then I think it's unfair. You know, because it also, I mean, what happened in my career, in a way, if you go from A to Z, so I started in Germany, 1991, made a movie for $60,000, a German fried movie, like Kentucky fried movie. So, and that movie turned out to make money. Even with five prints, me and my buddy Frank, we went from movie theater to movie theater, and then we sold the rights to UFA for TV and video. So we made money, and they gave us money for another movie. Then after four German movies, I went to US and made the first movie, Sanctimony, in the year 2000, my first English-speaking movie. And then I made three movies, Blackwood, Sanctimony, and Heart of America. It's a good school drama, loosely on the Little School Massacre orientated.
Can I ask you a little bit about Heart of America? Because that was a very controversial film for you. People called it exploitative. They thought that you were glorifying the idea of kids freaking out and shooting up a school. I watched Heart of America, and I didn't really feel that that was what you were doing, although you did seem to be very focused on a message. What was the message in your mind in making Heart of America?
Now, for me, when I looked in a lot of that school shootings where, like, not like a crazy guy goes into school and shoots everybody, like where the actually shooter is a school kid.
Right.
So, and I think to explain, for example, the Littleton situation was they took prescription drugs and that is not enough. I think, look, there are too many people that take drugs, too many people they have the availability of guns, and they still don't run amok. And I wanted to find out, that's the reason, like in my movie, like different kind of people shooting people, like Elizabeth Rosen shoots somebody, then the other guy based on revenge shoots his bullies. And I think it's this kind of combination of things who like mental illness, drugs, availability of guns. But there's also that factor X, what you just don't know, what pushes people over the edge and And so they destroy their whole future in shooting people up, because most of them getting shot then too or doing suicide. And
it ends up being kind of a prescient movie too, because you made it before a lot of these giant school shootings have happened, involving a lot of the things that you're talking about here, kids that are on drugs or need to be psychologically helped, and the ease that they can get their hands on their guns, whether they're taking them from their parents or just going and buying them legally. And it seems like a lot of the criticism of your movie as trying to glorify that falls flat now. It seems more like a warning. Like maybe you saw a trend in this country. I mean, the name of the movie, Heart of America, right? Is pointing at the problem of America and guns.
Yeah, and I saw that, for example, in Germany was one shooter who killed 22 people in Winnenden. But, and that was the specific thing, in Germany, like, if you have a gun, first of all, you have to be over 18, you have a gun. Then you have to lock your gun up in a safe. And that guy, his father was a sports shooter, and he was a sports shooter too, and he basically had the safe key. So he went, got the gun out, and killed 22 people. But that was the only school shooting in German schools ever with dead people.
Yeah.
And that has to do with the gun availability, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that is the thing. It's just tougher. And I think in Germany, if you have a member of a sports shooting club, so I have a gun license too, and I have guns, but they're locked up. My kids can never get my guns anywhere, even close to them. But that is very important to not be sloppy. And I have a lot of friends in U.S. They just have their gun in their night table.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Just in case. But, well, there's definitely kind of like a paranoia that a lot of people have about, guns. I mean, there's people on both sides. There's people that are just terrified to be around guns. There's like people I've seen actually cry shooting guns. And there's people that, they said they're very cavalier. And it's like, if we don't ensure that these guns are kept away from, especially children or people who can't make these decisions, especially like in a volatile time, like they're 16 years old going through high school. And then it's like, look, I can empower myself suddenly, and I can really strike back at these people whenever I want to, and show them I have power now.
If I can, like Adam Lanza, who committed
But it's really a fleeting power. It's fleeting because most people end up killing themselves, or they end up going to be in prison for the rest of their lives. So
right.
it's an illusion.
Right.
But it's an appealing illusion, I guess, at some points to some people.
Well, let's keep...
You cannot have your gun, loaded if you have children in the house, period.
Of course.
You cannot have it... it has to be out of reach... Or really hidden somewhere where the kids have no clue where that gun is.
Ideally, for most people, in a gun safe. Like you said, you have a safe, so you know that. You store your gun safely, so it's not like someone can just walk into your house and grab a gun.
You,
or anybody.
You do take a lot of political stances, not only in your interviews, but in your films and on your Twitter. Like some of the things on your Twitter that it says you like here is anti-pollution, anti-government corruption, public empowerment. Things of that nature. I've seen some interviews where you go on very full-on political. What do you make of, I mean, we just had a State of the Union address. What's the State of the Union according to, Uwe Boll?
let's say the one positive thing. There are a few things maybe we can see in Trump. But I think where he's actually on the right track is to get U.S. troops out of the Middle East and Afghanistan.
I agree.
And I don't think because it worked and it's done. No, I think because it's completely senseless. It's like it was from the beginning on completely senseless to do anything, to remove Saddam Hussein, what created then the ISIS, and now the ISIS is the enemy. They always find enemies wherever, right? But it never ends up in something... you have a victory and everybody is super happy that you came and destroyed everything, like Team America, right? So destroy everything and you say, no, we give you your country back. Good luck. it's kind of idiotic idea. And if, for example, Afghanistan, to be honest, like if you do a manhunt on Bin Laden, who was in Pakistan, but that is okay. But to invade a whole country for it, and then you have an endless war, what nobody ever will win, because the resistance is just too much, right? So you cannot. I watched the long doku from you mentioned it too. I love the Ken Burns dokus on Netflix. Yes. I watched them all. You know, the Vietnam War doku, I think, is like an amazing. Every school should show that doku in full length.
Oh, I couldn't fucking agree more. I'm actually, it's weird that you bring it up. I'm actually on the last episode of that. I've been watching it an episode a night before I go to bed, and you're absolutely right, man.
Yeah.
It taught me things that I didn't know about the Vietnam War, and put it in even a worse light than I thought, knowing that it was already a fucking total boondoggle where we got our asses handed to us, you know?
Yeah. And a lot of the soldiers, even of the CIA people, whatever, when they finally say, like, we were on the wrong side.
Yeah.
I mean, they were right. Reality. That was that idiotic idea of, to be honest, John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson looking like absolutely fucking assholes in that doku, because they started it.
Of course.
They started the Vietnam War.
And they perpetuated it.
Corrupt asshole regime who actually didn't have any followers. Like the North Vietnam, the Chiang Kai-shek, like all that people, they were the majority of the people. And yes, they were fighting for their lives, and they were never giving up because that was their country. And so it was that dragged out stupid war. And then interesting is that all that tapes, right, with Nixon on tape and Johnson on tape, and they know it all the way, like there will be no victory, but yeah, all about their image, their reputation, like how I get out of it without looking like a total loser.
See, they knew it behind the scenes.
What?
They knew it behind the scenes, but they didn't tell us. They knew in 1964 that they weren't going to win that war and kept it going into the 70s.
I mean,
ridiculous.
The parallels between Afghanistan and Vietnam are almost never ending. You have the French occupation.
Yeah, but we're on.
You
have coming up on 18 years for that war.
I mean, and it's insane. And these countries have all tried to do this. And occupying forces eventually were always going to be driven out of these countries because the indigenous people are always going to be there. People who've always lived there they're not just going to poof go away unless you kill them all. They're going to be there. And, you know, whatever political ideas that they're going to want to bring forth, I mean, that's for that society and that culture to determine. Ultimately.
So we recognize this cycle that's going on. What stops it, Uwe? What needs to change for us to learn the lesson of this military adventurism just ends up fucking us in the ass?
Yeah, I mean, what there are various things. I think when you see the budget spent on military, it's just insane. You know, I mean, if like... China spends, I think, $100 billion. Russia spends like $80 billion. Germany spends $60 billion. But U.S. spends $720 billion. And then the absurd per year. And then the absurd thing is that when Trump was running for president, he said our military is in shambles, like a complete disaster. Like there is not one tank driving anymore. I mean, you know, like he talked about it. Like a total disaster. And then as soon as he was president, he like, our military is the best. Yesterday in the State of Union too, right? So where he said like, we are just 10 times better as everybody else. Yeah, I mean, you spent also 10 times. But what war after the Second World War America finally won? Like, I mean...
None.
Nothing. So and that is the idea of fighting wars already is the wrong idea. Also, this kind of pissing contest with Russia, who basically has more nuclear bombs, is going back to Russia. No, I agree with Trump there. Russia broke all that agreements. But the solution is not now to go again in a Cold War situation.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's also not the
way.
Well,
so many people are making so much money off the whole thing because, I mean, you get all this money to defense contractors, and then the defense contractors give their money to the politicians, and then the politicians approve higher budgets so they can get more defense contractor money. I mean, it's just a fucking bunch of bullshit.
Well, let's put it this way. Let's say that there's like the F-35 jet, which is going to cost, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. The way it's always sold is this, like, oh, we're going to develop this new fighter jet. It's going to cost $35 billion. And people go, oh, great. And then, oh, cost overruns. And eventually you have the taxpayers of America on the line for like several hundred billion dollars. And it's like, oh, well, how does this scam work? And it's just a joke, dude. It's all about money. It's all about profiteering. And we can see it. Look at the defense lobbies. Look how much money they spend. And they all get these. They have these huge contracts and these huge budgets. And yet we're always told they need more money. Why do they need more money? For what? What else are they? What are they really doing? They're building this new advanced fighter jet that every time you see anything about this in the media, it's all about how it's fucked up. Oh, it's fucked up. Oh, we need to develop a new elevator technology for this ship to work right. I'm like, these people are fucking mad with power and money. It's obvious. It's just ridiculous shit.
So, oh, go ahead. Right.
I did want to. I don't want to spend too much of the time on politics because I did want to get back to movies.
Let me show
go
one
ahead.
Thing.
Yeah,
watch
go ahead.
YouTube. You find the doku. I think it's from Vice Media where they said how this is how winning looks like about Afghanistan. And they are amazing examples where whatever the device guys on the field, like, and you have like that fighter jets, and they gave it to the Afghanistan army, but of course nobody can fly that thing. So they're rotting there, but there's like $1 billion right there evaporizing. Helicopters, the same, a power plant. And then the best thing was in the doku is like, so they're going on a kind of, where you sell old tanks or old jeeps, whatever. And there they made a lot of money because, for example, whatever, you have a tank who basically it works very well. But so you break a mirror or whatever and say, look, that tank is actually garbage. So we have to sell it. And then they're allowed to sell that tank as garbage, but it's a full functioning tank.
Right, that's crazy.
And then they sell it to the Afghanistan, whatever, like the garbage guy. And then he sells it, of course, for way more money to the Taliban.
Of course.
And that's how it goes. It's so absurd. It's the best satire since like Catch 22, basically. And so I can only recommend to watch that thing. It's a long form on YouTube, like 70 or 80 minutes.
All right.
Stop ringing. So, but everything else from Trump to summarize it up. I think Trump is just in it for himself. He has no empathy. He gives a shit about basically everybody. That speech yesterday was just reading it from a teleprompter the first time, maybe, because he cannot write a speech like this.
Yeah.
And that is the thing. It's like, we always hope for the best, right? So he's on the red dot, basically. He can pull the trigger. But I think the Trump family are crooks. I mean, they are definitely tax evaders and use any political power they have now to set up the deals they're doing later to cash in on this presidency.
Yeah, no argument here. I do. I love the image on the top of your Twitter of you nailed to the cross. You have the MPAA logo, but you've changed the acronym to Must Punish All Artists. I know you're very critical of the MPAA. I was wondering if you could maybe give us your criticism of that institution.
Yeah, I mean, the main point is also, I think when you're over 18 or whatever, you can watch whatever you want. And so it's in general, in Germany, it's even worse. In Germany, they censored Rampage, like Rampage 1.
Right.
They said they don't, that he gets away with it is unacceptable. So they wanted to X-rate the movie, means it doesn't basically can get sold. And so we had to put in the end credits in Germany that he got catched by the police.
How stupid.
This is absurd shit, dude.
The funny thing is when the second part came out in Germany, people were saying like, but how got he out of jail? No, and then I had to give a lot of interviews and say like, no, because I was forced to do it. It's the most stupid bullshit. And I like... Scandinavia, for example, they don't have a rating system. So you, as a distributor, you determine what age group you market the film for, or what age group you write on a DVD box, or you say that is for 14 years old, 16 years old. It's your decision. And they do it responsible. You know, it's not that they releasing a porn movie in Denmark and writing like, PG. So they're more responsible with it. And I think the kind of censorship is always, it's always a bad idea.
Do you think that these ratings boards who are trying to protect us from certain types of content should just be abolished outright? Or
yes.
Do you think they need to be reformed?
No, I mean, or reformed or abolished. I mean, it's there has to be something else what can basically put in place. I mean, we cannot accept that we cannot think that the parents actually looking what the kids are watching. So there needs to be kind of a filter. You know, I mean, I'm not pro like showing porn on Treehouse. So, you know, like stuff like this, that is not acceptable.
Well, that's common sense, right?
What?
That just seems like common sense to me.
Yes.
And allowing the people making. Yeah.
I mean, if you put it in the hands of the distributors, they will not abuse the situation because then they're getting sued.
Right. They're getting sued. There's tons of blowback. Nobody wants to buy their films because they're the people that sold porn to kids.
Well, not that we know the MPAA is so flawed, because, I mean, in America, it's like violence can almost be unlimited, but then there's any sex or, like, profanity. It's like, whoa, they need to be rated R. They need to be NC-17. It's like, why?
Well, it's interesting you bring up violence, because it's something I wanted to ask you about, Uwe. You just gave kind of a pretty stark anti-war message and anti-violence, at least by nation states. And yet your movies, a lot of them seem to revel in violence. And I'm wondering how you see your movies. There's an argument in this country that violence in movies leads to violent tendencies in people.
Or in video games as well.
Or in video games. Do you think that has any merit at all?
No. I think that you have, for example, with the video games, you have... a lot of people that run amok in that school violence situation, they were isolated, lonely kids. So what you play video games to bridge time. But I don't think that the video game made them run amok. I mean, look at how many people playing Fortnite right now. That billions of people, actually, like hundreds of millions of kids, right? But are they now trying to get a gun in the real world to shoot everybody up? I mean, no. And I don't think there is a direct connection. It can definitely maybe trigger in somebody who is already in a mental instable situation, kind of idealizing things. But I always try to do... violence. I presented in a forget the video game based movies now. See the Rampage, Assault on Wall Street. I have this kind of amok situations, but I think I show it dry and hard and not like heroic.
Dude, sure. I was when I was watching Postal, because when we did the episode on you, I'd not actually sat down and watched any of your films from start to finish yet. I just had never, you know, whatever. I hadn't encountered it in my life.
You basically knew them by reputation.
Right. When I decided we were going to do this, we were doing this interview with you, you reached out to us. I was like, well, I should probably check out a few of his movies. The only one I actually got around to watching, because of whatever busy schedule, that was Postal. And I loved... the fact that you shot a bunch of kids in the
Germany
theme
land
park
thing.
Or whatever. Yeah. And I love that there was a scene, because I'd seen the scene in so many movies where someone is pushing a baby stroller in the street and then it gets run over by a truck. But it turns out it was just filled with cans or something. And I love the fact that it was just like, nope, they just straight up ran over a fucking baby and didn't even notice. Like, I don't know, I love that sort of stuff because you just don't see it. It just seems like so many movies and filmmakers and stuff are just totally ballless in any sort of like regard like that. I like the fact that you're willing to just do it and not even necessarily for, you know, some deeper purpose or anything, but just for like, hey, you know, this game Postal was about shock value, so I'm going to give you some shock value to this movie. And I just find it so strange that there's so many things that are just subtly taboo, like in a movie.
Killing kids.
Yeah, like, you know, you can kill as many adults as you want. You can just butcher them and no one cares. PG-13. But, you know, you kill one kid in a movie, people are like, oh, that went too far or, you know, whatever. So I thought that was pretty awesome.
There's also bestiality in the movie.
Oh, there's all kinds of stuff in that movie.
Dude.
I mean, the Postal begins with the 9/11 hijackers being like, we're not getting enough virgins for this. Let's go to like Cabo or something. And then the passengers storm in and end up being the ones who crash it into the building. And I don't know. I mean, I thought it was pretty cool that you went in all those like super offensive directions and stuff.
You're an edgelord, though.
Right. So I mean, I love
this kind of is the ultimate movie to someone like you, TJ.
I mean, yeah, it's pretty far out there. I dug that about it for sure.
Yeah, so but that is what I felt. I was so fed up with all the video game based movies I did at that point. It was, right. And then Postal was the first movie after a long time I wrote again. To be honest, I could not write Alone in the Dark or something. Not because it's just like I cannot identify with subject matters like this. But I was lucky with House of the Dead because it made money. So, and I'm not like subsidized. So it means like I had to raise money. I had to go and find people investing in movies. And it was also not like how you mentioned in Germany that the people wanted to lose their money. They only wanted the year they invested in the movie, they could write that money down as an investment and paid less taxes. So, but in the following years coming up, they were expecting payouts. And when in House of the Dead, that Heart of America was a flop, and then House of the Dead basically tripled the money. So now you have investors. You can say, let me do Saul on Wall Street or Darfur about the genocide in Sudan. They would say, yeah, fuck yourself. You have to keep going with your video game based movies, right? So I mean, that was the thing why I made so many video game movies.
So you felt pressured by the people who were investing in the films to make those kind of films?
Yes. And they were also the only movies ever got real releases, like with Lionsgate, with Fox, getting theatrical releases around the globe. And but then I felt like this kind of, it doesn't really reflect me as a filmmaker anymore. And and I felt with Postal, I go back to my German frat movie roots, where
oh, yeah.
You basically go to the trash, but political, completely incorrect, like NC-17 humor. What I personally, I love this kind of stuff. For me, most of the comedies, they of course they try to whatever. Wedding Crashers was a funny movie, but all that movies trying in the end to do this kind of the positive effect, the positive story, like the asshole turns into he fell in love and whatever, right? So and so they always try this. Hangover, I think, was close to a Postal humor. What I especially the first one, what I really like, and but there are not a lot of movies like this. And I felt with Postal, I can just give it all and give a shit about everything.
Right, and I feel like especially like in a comedy. You know, I think at least for a certain type of comedy, there has to be really no boundaries or as few boundaries as possible, because it just has to be, if you're going to lampoon everything and try to show the absurdity of the world through your own eyes, you can't be worried about, oh, well, what are people going to think of this or what are people going to think of that? It has to, you know, be a fucking a gut punch, you know?
Yes, and then, for example, in German frat movie, we had a scene where, and so I used a real situation where actually two guys escaped from a prison and they took hostages, and they were with the hostages in the car, and that happened for real. And then the police stormed the car, and he shot the hostage in the head, and then the other, they both got only injured, they both got in jail then. So and that when I shot German frat movie, that actually happened, and we built that scene again. And then he's losing control over in the movie, then losing control over his machine gun and in the school bus, and they're actually killing like 28 kids. And sweet. Then they're not getting, but then to put it on top is like, but all the kids turned out to be migrants. They were not German. So they're not getting charged for it. And wow. So that was. Said that was very bad, right? So it was like on purpose I put that in, and at 1991, I mean 28 years before the you know, like, but I did that on purpose, because so you can criticize like all kinds of things at the same time, but that is dark humor as it best, right? I love that scene still,
yeah,
where they they're only migrants, so what the fuck. But that is the stuff what I feel. In comedies, you have the big opportunity to basically answer with humor like a trend. And I remember when Postal was shown in New Jersey at the film festival, and the people, like the mayor, didn't came because I was the opening film.
Yeah.
They make fun out of September 11th. I want nothing to do with it. And then I had after the movie discussion with people. They were like very upset. And I said, look, the people at September 11th, it was a horrific attack. But Postal makes fun out of the terrorists, out of the total idiotic idea. You do something and you go.
Yeah, you're going to get virgins.
You kill thousands of people and you do something to serve God? I mean, right. What the fuck? Right? So I said, it's nothing. There is nothing in a Postal where we making fun out of the victims. But now where I'm here, I said, is what is also wrong is that what New York and what happened after September 11th, the Iraq war was wrong because Iraq had nothing to do with Osama bin Laden. And the Saudis are still our best friends till today. They can chop up fucking Khashoggi and nothing happens, right? So right. It's like
they can sponsor genocides in Yemen as well. So.
They sponsor Bin Laden is from Saudi Arab, right? So and because they have so much money, now we have to find somebody else to blame for September 11. But they had the people all along, and they're still friends with them because they have the oil. That is the stupidity where a president at Bush at that time were able with fake evidence to convince the majority of the people that Saddam Hussein has anything to do with September 11. I think Saddam Hussein was one of the few Middle East dictators. I mean, a butcher, and I'm not, I give a shit that he's killed, but he definitely was zero religious at
well,
all.
Yeah, he had nothing to do, like he hated ISIS. He hunted them down. So like that was the truth. We were told he's harboring them, and he's actually one of the few Middle East dictators that were
well, it was Al-Qaeda at the time.
Al-Qaeda, yeah. Right, sorry.
Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. But whatever. I mean, you lose track of who the new enemy is.
Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, ISIS.
So I wanted to ask you about Rampage, because I watched that movie, and it reminded me of another film that I really love and that I've watched a bunch of times as a kid because it's so cathartic to watch, Falling Down, about a man that has had enough of all of the bullshit in life and just goes on kind of a spree. And this was that same kind of movie, and I felt that same kind of catharsis. The violence in these types of movies, do you think that you're reflecting something that you see in all people, that we all have this kind of switch in us that might be flipped if we're pushed too far? Or at least we all have the desire to think about maybe, yeah, one of these days, man, I'm not going to put up with this anymore.
Yeah, you remember the scene in Postal with the Chinese driver?
Yes.
Where he goes and kills her. So yeah. It's like that. I have that every day in Vancouver, right? So in Vancouver, we have 30% Chinese population, and they just cannot drive a car. It's like me coming from Germany, I'm used to drive fast, but it's like they just are completely retarded. And it's not racist, it's just packed. Yeah. So and you know, and Falling Down was also one of that movies. I loved that movie, and because it shows, especially the beginning, right? The first half is just great. The
McDonald's, it's beautiful.
Yeah. So where you have that all the like the thing is like, you know that situations, and you want to do something, but you're not because you don't want to go to jail. And but we have that. I think we all have it. But that is what I meant very early with Heart of America, that factor X, we don't know what finally pushes you over the edge. I felt that the last third of Falling Down was always for me kind of a letdown.
I agree.
You know, because he was
it doesn't hold up to the promise of
psycho. Yeah, you know, and I didn't want it to be him only a psycho. I wanted to be that it's kind of more real. And I tried that with Bill Williamson, right? In Rampage, it's like he is he crazy? Is he a mass murderer? Yes, but he also kind of nails it.
Yeah.
He also is kind of like very controlled, knowing exactly what he's doing. And he's not totally off. I mean, it's, you know, like where you have sometimes the feeling like, maybe.
Some of the best films reflect, like The Shining, for example. There's films you can look at, and obviously there's a story there, and you can recognize the story, but then there's elements to that you kind of debate about or you don't really know. And I think sometimes it's good to leave those nebulous and just show the visual aspect of the film instead of being expository and explain every little thing, like, this is why I did it, this, you know, and connecting all the dots. Because when you do that, you kind of take the person out of the story somewhat. And like you guys said, with Falling Down, the last third of the film, it lets you down. I agree with you. It's like when he loses his shit in that fucking fast food place, when he's dealing with people and he just can't take it anymore. To take that away from someone, from it to be a personal thing, just, oh, he's just a piece of shit. He's just a psychopath.
It's almost like walking back the criticism. You know, Uwe was talking earlier about using Postal and the comedy as a way to point at society and go, hey, this is fucked up.
Yeah, sadly.
But in a funny way. Well, he uses the action movie in the same way in Rampage and in Falling Down. You know, this is the same idea. Like, I'm pointing out the ills in society. Everybody's been fucked over by walking into a convenience shop and paying $5 for a $2 item, you know? And we all have felt that desire to bust that shop up. And in the same way in Rampage, you know, he's just a young man that's had enough.
And it's interesting because, you know, obviously, Uwe, you've been very fascinated with this concept of what makes people snap, what makes them go on a rampage, or, you know, you have like the Assault on Wall Street stuff, the Rampage movies, Postal, whatever. There's all these movies about
people reaching their limits,
someone being pushed too far, or Heart of America, you know, all these movies about people being pushed too far and snapping. And it seems like, you know, that's something that's going on a lot in America right now, because it's just more and more shootings, more and more shootings, more and more people are reaching that point of like, I can't fucking take this anymore.
And people turning to drugs increasingly, like the opioid.
Yeah, the opioid crisis and stuff, too. But I mean,
there's a lot of
people turn into the violence and stuff. I mean, like, I feel like, you know, not a lot of filmmakers have dealt with that subject matter, even though it's such an important subject matter and becomes an increasingly important subject matter. Why do you think people shy away from that, and why don't you shy away from that?
I think one of the big reasons is that the typical LA producers, directors, they live in a cocoon, like they're living in a fake world. Right. You know, when they're always sitting, whatever, Jimmy Kimmel, or, you know, like in their talk shows, and then they're acting like they're totally normal and grounded still. But they're not. They have personal assistants, they have like bodyguards, massage therapists, whatever, wardrobe consultants. They're living in a total bullshit world. And that bullshit world, in a way, doesn't translate in seeing what's actually really happening on the streets or happening in the soul of the people. I mean, for example, I said 6 months before the election that Trump will win that election.
Yeah.
And that was for me very easy to predict, because he got the biggest screen time, airtime everywhere.
Yeah.
And people hated Hillary Clinton and all that. And I see the same mistakes. The Democrats still doing the same mistakes, right? The Democrats are, and that is coming back to the convenience store or the McDonald's scene or whatever, is this kind of passive aggressive. And a lot of people hate that, including myself.
Yes.
You know, this kind of like being friendly, but whatever, you're in the middle of the forest, it's pissing rain, and the guy tells you, you have to pick up the poo from your dog. And you think like, why should I use a plastic bag? I mean, what is worse, to produce plastic bags to pick up poo, or to just leave the poo somewhere in the fucking forest? It's not that I leave the poo on the sidewalk.
Right.
So like, that is the thing. And then like like my mentality is then basically to just keep walking, whatever. But if a guy then really stops me or whatever and says like, no, you have to pick up the poo, then I say, you shut the fuck up, or you will be with the poo in the fucking forest. And that is the thing. It's like, then I totally snap, right? So,
right.
I mean, if he would attack me, I would just nail him. But the point is I cannot stand people like this. They just, I see the same in that when we talk about Black Panther or whatever, to just give a movie an Oscar nomination, because now it's black superheroes. Right. It's just completely absurd.
And we've had, I mean, there was black superheroes in the, I mean, we had Blade back in the 90s and all kinds of stuff, and no one, it was never,
nod for Blade.
Those movies never patted themselves on the back for hiring a black dude to play a superhero.
I mean, we're just at the ultimate, almost seems like a pinnacle now of virtue signaling, of basically the superficial appearance of something is far more important than the substance of it. And it's just sad. And it's just really sad that we've come to that point.
Kind of springboarding off that point, Uva, that you were making about this fantasy world that a lot of these movie industry people live in. Another one of your tweets that I remember reading said that you hate actors.
Yeah.
And that actors are just a pain in the fucking ass to work with.
I remember specifically attacking Ben Kingsley.
Ben Kingsley. And, you know, is that one of the hardest things about making a movie, is dealing with all of these egos and the demands and the contractual bullshit that these people that don't live in reality foist upon you as a director and a producer of a film?
Yeah, I mean, we had, like, tell you a story from Alone in the Dark. So first day at Alone in the Dark, Stephen Dorff didn't want to come out of his trailer because he had in his contract he get the same trailer like Christian Slater. And then his trailer was just a different model, but it was whatever, 30 centimeters shorter. So and then we went to the trailer, and I actually took Christian Slater out of his trailer and said, you have to switch the trailers with Stephen Dorff. And then Christian Slater and me were in front of the trailer, and we said, look, you can switch the trailer. You get Christian Slater's trailer. Don't worry about it. No problem at all. But, of course, the first thing he did was he called his agent and said, Christian Slater has a bigger trailer as me. What is that? And then he called the production and told him, you're not leaving your trailer. So, and this kind of absurdity, and that is why it has a little to do with personal experience with actors, right? Ben Kingsley took $1 million to do Blood Rain. And, and then he was so friendly on set, whatever. Like, I have nothing against Ben Kingsley, intelligent, very good actor. But then later he gave me his cell number. So I said, okay, now we do actually a premiere of Blood Rain in the Chinese theater in L.A. And he hanged up on me.
He's like, nope.
And then first I saw it, came on the clicked the phone off, whatever, by accident. So I called him again, didn't pick up the phone. Then his agent called me and said, don't contact Ben, Sir Ben, anymore.
Right. He wasn't too good to take the fucking money, you know?
Exactly. And that is what I think, that double-faced, total BS, I just cannot handle it.
Well, while we're on the subject of actors, I've always had maybe an irrational hatred of Ray Liotta, and I know you've worked with him a few times, so I got to ask, you know, am I justified in hating Ray Liotta, or is he a cool guy?
No, you're more justified.
Awesome.
It's like, I mean, it's not an easy character, right? He's kind of, look at the characters he's playing. A lot of times it's these miserable people, right? And he is like this a lot of times.
I knew it.
In Dungeon Siege, he really didn't want to, play the part. Fantasy, it's not his genre. And suddenly, it's more a thriller. He played the cop. That was easier for him. That was like, he was more relaxed in the cop in the movie. And but he's a professional. He's not like not doing anything. So he delivers, and you buy Ray Liotta because of the face, his appearance. You know what he's doing. So
but he's a dour sort of miserable asshole.
So you can say yes, but it's also like, in general, when they do generalization of actors, it's like, it's not like I have a lot of actor friends also. It's like, I have nothing against the actors, and most of the movies are just shot with the actors, but this kind of, when you shoot a movie, everybody acts like now we are friends forever.
Right,
but it's just not the case. It's just like, as soon as the last paycheck is paid and the movie is over, you barely see people again. You barely hear people again. They don't answer your email or whatsoever. And when you have like a personal relationship with somebody and says, look, I have an interesting project, you want to read it. And if you like it, I maybe can make you an offer or whatever. And then that never happens.
Ask you this. Are there any actors you've worked with as far as big name, or any actors you've known big name that you think are an exception to the sort of prima donna stuff you're talking about? Or
yeah, like a dude that was a joy to work with, you know, an actor that you would want to work with again and have in your films just by the sheer fact that he was great and easy to work with. Or she.
I mean, look, Michael Paré, Clint Howard, they are not big stars, but they were a lot of my movies, and I really love working with them, and I'm still very good friends with both of them. The more like smaller actors, like Brandon Fletcher of Rampage, I would always work with him. From the big stars, Jason Statham and Ron Perlman, they were both absolutely a pleasure to work with.
Cool.
They have good dry humor. They are on set on time. They make the movies. So, but you know also that you will not have necessarily a friendship with them.
Right.
But they do a great job. So I would always love to work with them again. Also, Christian Slater was a total team player in Alone in the Dark and easygoing. I have nothing against them to work with them again. But overall, actors are not the person you think they are, right? So it's not they are kind of insecure, not convinced. They are very, let's say, they would not like really fight for their what they think about the world or life or whatever. You know, like, it's different. There is no principle to them. It's just like they do whatever.
It's all about ego. So let me ask you. You have. We're kind of drawn towards the end here, so I wanted to ask you just how many films have you been involved with the making of in some capacity? Because I know it's over 35. But
I directed 30, produced and directed 30,
mm-hmm.
and then there were another 10 or 15 I produced or was involved or got an executive producer credit, getting some money or sales for the movie. But as a producer, when I was not directing, I never go to set or something. I just watch what they're doing the days, because I hate that as a director.
I got you.
So I felt they need to do their thing, and they have to do it the way they come to results, or you know. So it's a little. I think them more as a director, but when I like mix myself in discussions, like for example Bryan Singer, I have trashed him into the ground. I think he deserves it to get outed and be taken out of the business.
Right.
When we shot Alone in the Dark, he shot X-Men. Like we were in the Vancouver Film Studios in with Alone in the Dark, and he was the next door with X-Men, and we heard them yelling, and he was not there, and the crew from them were at our craft service because they were not shooting, because he was sleeping, drugged, never came to the set. And I felt that, you think about it, that was 1992 on 2003 2002 2003, and Halle Berry had huge fights with him, saw her storming off the set and stuff like this, and he gets $10 million now to do Red Sonja. You know, like, I mean, you think, like, how can Hollywood never be, like seeing, like, people like this who go with every movie over budget, who are unreliable, who are drug users, and people, you know, like, what are the consequences for these people?
Possible abusers. I mean,
And
you're
personally, no consequences, clearly.
You're absolutely right. And I think, I feel like now more than ever, there are more young, enthusiastic people wanting to make movies that are getting passed over for old fucking busted out druggies like Bryan Singer.
To make the same schlock.
To make the same garbage fucking X-Men fucking superhero bullshit. And it's just like, when is the movie industry going to wake the fuck up and start finding some good ideas and some good movies and funding that shit?
Yeah, you know, and then you have, like, take a James Gunn. I know him since Slither. He shot that year with Sean Williamson, and so we met various times. And I felt Guardians of the Galaxy, the first one, was great. Because it was different, right? I was laughing my ass off. There was different. The style, I could actually finally watch again, like a kind of a superhero a movie, and had really fun watching it. And then he gets outed because of old, stupid Twitter, whatever. You know, like, it's so absurd. And the biggest mistake, now you have it with Liam Neeson, like, have to say, oh, I'm so sorry that I ever thought about revenge on whatever. So it's But that is what I meant with the problem of living in that air balloon with agents and managers. They have no balls.
Right.
Like, it's completely, they feel sorry for whatever they say. If they make a gay joke, if they make a joke about minorities, if they make, they oh my God, now I'm in Twitter outed by whatever it is.
An angry mob of armchair activists.
Uva, I did want to ask you, because I know a lot of people out there watching this might not be familiar with your work or whatever. Maybe they only know the video game movies that you did in the early 2000s. I wanted to just have you throw out a recommendation for someone out there who's not seen any of your movies. Like, what would you put forward to them as, like, you know, start here. This is the first movie of mine that I want you to see if you're going to, you know, give my body of work a chance.
Yeah, watch Attack on Darfur about the in Africa, about the genocide in Darfur. It's a very strong movie. Like, think about Hotel Rwanda, but even more violent. It's a very good movie. I think Assault on Wall Street is a very solid movie. I think Assault on Wall Street is good for people to watch that are more mainstream.
Right.
Because it's not so extreme like Rampage or Postal. And it's really like a slow-moving story what ends up in also in big violence. But it's not so slow as the new detective.
And certainly a lot of people can relate to wanting to go shoot up Wall Street, too. So,
yeah, but it was, for example, that was for me a point where I felt like, think about how many shootings are in the United States of America. And then you had the financial crash and 6,000 people did suicide based on the consequences of losing their houses, losing everything they had. But nobody went to Goldman Sachs and just shot everybody. I mean, it's for me like the.
They'd rather just destroy their own lives than get any sort of vengeance on the people who wronged them.
Yes, but then people go and shoot people in the church or shoot people in the whatever in the McDonald's.
It seems like our rage in this country is misguided.
Oftentimes it is.
You know, and I know, Uva, you don't have much time left, but if you've got a couple of minutes, there's something we covered in the show that I feel like I'd like to give you the opportunity to respond to.
Yeah.
There's a drumbeat of criticism that surrounds you about how you finance your films. And there are people that point the finger and say he's a scammer, he borrows this money, and then he makes a shitty film that he knows is shitty just so it doesn't make money, so it doesn't pay any taxes on it, blah, 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 blah. Is that at all a fair critique?
No, it's not. It's like that is the wrong point of view in seeing. So what I did, I raised money in Germany between 2000 and 2005. You could write off film investments in the year where you invest. So let's say you have a dentist. The dentist makes $300,000 a year in Germany, as an example.
Right.
He would pay $150,000 in taxes. So if he puts that $300,000 in a movie, he pays zero taxes. So basically, he has only $150,000 paid, right? But the rest would otherwise went to the government. But so he put $300,000 in the movie, and now he hopes that the $300,000 getting in the next 10 years that the movie makes revenues and he actually makes money. So and that was always the short form. What the people maybe on purpose said wrong is this kind of like, I have to lose the money and make bad movies on purpose so that the money is gone.
Right.
But we pre-sold all our movies everywhere around the globe. I mean, you can get Alone in the Dark from Australia to Russia everywhere. And and actually my movies from 110 German like film funds, I was with four of my funds in the top 10. So in top 10 means in return of the money. So nobody else had better returns as me because a lot of German funds just handed money over to Hollywood and never got paid back. And so from this point of view, that was just not true. After 2005, that rule was gone. So I could not raise any more money from German investors after 2005. So I had to go and make movies as normal producers basically do. Like you pre-sell the movie, you bank the money. In Canada, you get 38% back from whatever you pay. So it means like I give a guy $100, I get $38 back from the Canadian government here as a labor tax refund.
Right.
That is
right.
The reason it's so busy here in Vancouver. They shoot one movie after the other. So so that is how we finance then the movies. And a lot of the later movies, with the money I made on the first movies, I lost money on the full. I lost money on Assault on Wall Street. I have never recouped the full budget. And that was one of the reasons after Rampage 3, I felt, Uwe, you have to stop it. Like, I mean, right. I can just keep spending all my money. And then that was it. And but I have family, I have kids and everything. So I had to make a stop loss move. And that is the reason I stopped shooting. And I can do only movies in the future if like Netflix or other players pay it.
Well, you're trying to crowdfund a film right now, right? You're doing another In the Name of the King?
No, that was an idea, but I don't believe that is Gary Otto, my producer, right? But I don't believe in crowdfunding. I don't think it works. For me, it didn't work out ever. Maybe Spike Lee had positive things with it, but not for me. And I don't think we get a proper budget together over crowdfunding.
Right. So it's pretty hard to raise that kind of money. That kind of source.
I mean, like the Angry Video Game Nerd he raised like $250,000. I mean, it's a fun film, but it's not really a great film. It's not something you're like, I'm glad that this was funded. Like, I kind of agree with you. I don't think that most things are ever going to get enough of a budget to make a serious film.
So
like
let me ask you. So do you feel like you're retired from the directing gig at this point, or do you feel like there are some more Bull films coming our way in the future?
I mean, that is the thing. I'm working actively on doing a documentary about trophy hunters. Like, I think like the Trump kids and stuff like this, it needs to get stopped. When you read the facts, it's like in 20 years, there will be no rhino, no hippos, elephants, giraffes. They're all getting killed by retarded, crazy people.
Yeah, fuck those people.
Yeah, absolutely.
At the behest of rich people.
You know
too.
What's funny is they say, "Oh, but it funds all the preservation." It's like, why don't those people just give? Why don't they just get rich people to give money to them and not kill the animal?
Yeah, that'd be like, nice, wouldn't it?
You know, wouldn't that just? Why don't just do that instead?
Yeah,
that makes have their trophy.
Upset, you know, like it's not nothing against if somebody hunts something and eats it. It's a different thing. But to just pay $25,000 on a website and then you go to Africa and
a hunter going and killing a deer when the deer population is plentiful to get some venison is one thing, but someone going and killing a rare animal just so they can have some fucking faggoty photo op with its body, you know, that's just fucking disgusting. So
yeah. That is as low as it can get, right? I mean, that is like killing for just bloodlust and not, you know, the Chinese, they do the rhino horns. They think that it's like Viagra, whatever, Cialis, right?
They just got to get the little Chinese dicks hard and all that,
Sort of it like this. They think it's a good medicament. They still should get shot on the spot trying to kill rhinos.
I agree.
And I would love to make a doku not only showing that, but also like getting that step further. Further means confronting politics of both parties. Yeah. Like, why there is no law? Why there is never anything said on the political, also from the Democrats, zero, Bill Clinton, Obama. Like, this kind of like, we have to stop, like, before it's all extinct, we have to do things to stop it. And I mean, like, we have to send, why not sending the SEALs over there? You know, like saying, like, you know what? Like, we did so much bullshit around the globe with military force. Now let's do something good one time.
The fucking A.
Yeah, totally, utterly agree with you on that point.
All right, so we are running out of time here. I wanted to give you the floor for any last word, any other things you wanted to say to the audience out there watching this or anything like that.
I mean, I'm thankful that I had the chance here to have a longer discussion, and I enjoyed your show in the first time. Otherwise, I would not said like it would say it makes no sense. But I think it was a good talk, and I mean that is the problem, you know, like the real problem. What I would hope for is, of course, for example, take Megan Allison, right? So there are so many super billionaire rich idiots in the film business, and then what kind of movies they produce?
Garbage.
You know,
shit.
I mean, horrible. You know what happened to Paul Thomas Anderson? I mean, that There Will Be Blood was my favorite film in the last 10 years.
Fucking A.
Yeah, and then he meets like this kind of billionaire daughter, and he shoots one absolutely disaster after the other, where you think like, what the fuck happened to the guy from Boogie Nights? And the same with their other directors like this too. And I think the grit is gone. So I hoped for that one point, whatever, one billionaire guy who wants to go to media and says like, we want a Bourne movie and we want that it hurts.
Yeah,
and that is what I hope for. I don't think it will happen. I don't know, but it's really like it's so as a move, not only as a director, but also as a movie fan. All my life, I feel back like you even then like Dances with Wolves. It was a masterpiece, a super movie, made me totally emotional. I loved that movie. There are not one of this level of movie. I'm not even starting about the Deer Hunter, Apocalypse Now, and all that movies. There was not one movie of that quality shot in the last 5 to 8 years. When you see that movies running for Oscars, it's like a total joke.
Yeah, I don't even watch the fucking Oscars anymore.
It's a toilet. It's a joke. I mean,
I can't even. I mean, look, I used to be a major theater goer. I can't even.
You can't anymore.
I can't even drag my. Someone gave me for Christmas a gift card to the movie theater around here. I haven't used it once because every time I check it out,
it's like somebody.
There's never anything playing that I even remotely want to see. It just looks like fucking trash from fucking the floor to the ceiling.
Like, I saw Bohemian Rhapsody, and that was like kind of just like, what is this? Like, it's just like a very underwhelming look at Freddie Mercury and Queen. And I mean, like, a lot, and it's up for like the best picture. And I'm just like, this is not a best picture. Like, There Will Be Blood, the film you show, that's a best picture film in my eyes. Like, something like that, something that blows you away with the visual elements, with the dialogue, with the performances. And it's like, we're just not getting that. We're just getting fucking superhero movies now. Like, yep, there you go. And it's just like, what have we come to? And the Oscars have just made themselves totally irrelevant. The film industry, I feel, is just increasingly irrelevant to people. And like, I mean, obviously we have so many options now. So now it's just like, it's so superficial. Like I said, I see that with so much now. It's just a superficial look to get people to fucking click on it and go, oh, I might watch this movie. Oh, that might appeal to me.
I'd love to see an Uwe Boll documentary. A lot of people might not know. You kind of started even before the German Fried movie, right, with a documentary called Boxen?
Yeah.
I wasn't able to find it. I really wanted to try and find it because it's an interesting parallel between you and Stanley Kubrick, who we covered in an episode directly preceding your episode. You both started with a documentary about boxing.
Yeah, I mean, it's and I did another one, but it was also never released, about a retirement home close to my hometown. And we shot like for 3 weeks there with like very amateurish cameras at the Betamax. And but it was very bitter because you see the old people lonely dying, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And the name is Valley of the Death, basically. And it was a very depressing documentary. As I said, it's lost. I don't know where it is, but it was a good school to start looking deeper. You know, like one of my biggest goals in life, and it's also like there's an Austrian writer, Thomas Bernhard, who was very much influencing me. Give you only the mini roundup, but so he was very famous, and he died. He's from Austria, and in his testament, he said it's not allowed to play my stage plays anymore anywhere because I hate you all. And so he was never married, never had kids, whatever. And then after his death, it came out, and he was always cynical. He never like. He gave a shit, basically. So after his death, a little book came out what he wrote about his childhood, that when he was like in the Second World War, he was 6 years old, he was 4 years in a tuberculosis hospital in the death room because they gave up on him. And they pumped up his lung with air to put the lung back together. And during, so he wasn't thinking about it, you're like 6 years old till you're like 10 years old, you see only people dying and you're in a hospital room. And then at one point, he walked out of that hospital. In the end of the Second World War, it was total chaos. So he walked out of the hospital and started as a newspaper boy. And then he turned into the biggest Austrian stage writer of all times. And every American writer I know would make money out of that childhood story.
Yeah.
He got the Nobel Prize. They were totally launched him, the U.S. agents, you know, like that typical Bush. And he never told that to anybody where he came from, what actually happened to him. And he wrote in one of that, in that book, he said, like, in the most important moments of your life, you cannot give in. And that was really, that drove me my whole career.
That's a great message. Thank you for joining us today, Uva. It's been great talking to you. It's on my bucket list to eat at Bajas. I want to sit down and have a decadent meal at your restaurant, and I'm going to do it. So one of these days. Thank you for joining us. Is anybody else want to say goodbye to Uva here?
Yeah, man. Thank you so much for taking the time. Really enlightening interview. Thank you so much.
We appreciate you giving us this opportunity to delve deeper into what you've accomplished, what you've done, the films you've made. And I think that it's just awesome. Like, whatever anyone out there wants to say about the quality of your films or whatever, no one can deny that, you know, there's a lot of people out there like me that are just like, oh, I want to make a movie someday or something. But, you know, you've actually done it. You've made 30 plus films. I think it's a fucking incredible accomplishment, and I appreciate you giving us some of your valuable time here today.
Perfect. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Have a good one, Uva.
Vancouver, email me, right? So we meet in the restaurant.
We'll do.
We will do.
We'll do.
Sounds great.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.